are particularly grateful tonight to two friends of the Poetry Center, Hunter Wessels and Boki Choi, who have made the visit possible, from the distinguished poet Rowan Flint. Our thanks to them. We've been interested recently in talking about influences and talking about the influences of older poets on younger poets, but there are other influences that are important as well. Hunter studied with Professor Flint at Georgetown University, and although he's gone into the field of medicine, he remains a serious reader of poetry, and Rowan seems to have had that effect on a number of students around the country. We've been hearing tales of the Renaissance people he's influenced from here to there, so it's an opportunity to celebrate that kind of influence on the part of a professor, as well as the work of this writer. Originally from Park River, North Dakota, Rowan Flint has lived for many years in Silver Spring, Maryland, where he taught at Georgetown University from 1968 until his retirement last year. He is the author of 8 poetry books, including And Morning in 1975, Resuming Green, Selected Poems, 1965 to 1982, Stubborn, selected by Dave Smith for the 1990 National Poetry Series, Pigeon, published in 1991, and the ninth, Easy, which will be published this spring by LSU Press. Among his awards and distinctions, he's been named the Poet Laureate of Maryland in 1995. He's the recipient of both a Discovery Grant and a Poetry Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. He was a silver medalist in the Council for Advancement and Support of Education's National Professor of the Year Award in 1987, and he recently completed a residency at the Cadillac of Arts Colonies, the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio facility in Italy. He's also published 3 books in translation from Bulgarian, and one of his books, Pigeon in the Night, was published in a bilingual edition, Bulgarian and English. Flint's work has been likened to that of Chekhov and James Wright. Of his National Poetry Series award-winning book, Stubborn, his North Dakota compatriot, Thomas McGrath, wrote, "Few have written with such powerful candor about themselves, and few have celebrated so well the homely, the mad, and the lost." James Wright found Flint's purity of feeling beyond question, a purity fulfilled in writing. And that purity is perhaps most remarkably embodied in the beautiful poem, A Letter Home. Flint's poems have the plain style of Wright and the dramatized clarity of emotion of Chekhov, but I also see in his book, Pigeon, a raucous and tender whimsy in both mood and language, which creates the persona of Pigeon, in the manner of Berryman's Henry, or Linda Gregg's Alma, or Zbigniew Herbert's Mr. Cogito, a fictive stand-in for the self that allows a playful freedom, at once emotionally close to home and aesthetically remote. Pigeon, a plain and clumsy bird. This particular bird knows himself to be a compulsive meddler, needler, and nag. Pigeon sings out his contradictory self-acceptance and self-castigation in the haltingly perfect music of human imperfection. Please welcome Rowan Flint.
Thank you. Skin. If the wood is good grain, and the carpenter, the fit, the caulking, the cask will be good. And if the grapes are good, the wood and the wine will improve each other in the dark long days of aging. The separate tastes of earth will taste again and change again each other until, like membrane, somehow in and between the wood and wine, there will be no separation, wood from dark, from wine. When this goes on, anything can happen. go back to mystery. And I'm grateful to my small poem for teaching me this again, that my God is still the moment where the wood is no longer itself, where the wine is no longer only itself. That's a poem from an early book out of print now, and I've never read here before, so I take the liberty of reading some few early poems before moving to some later ones. Can you hear me in the back row? I mean, any trouble at all when I'm reading as quietly as this? Good. This is a poem called Say It. Having lent my apartment to visiting friends, I was sleeping in a strange basement, and I was wakened by a crumb in my ear. I tried to shake it out, tossing my head. No luck. It was not a crumb. Though I didn't know it yet, it was a bug. Not small. So burrowed in, my friend couldn't see it when I finally called her to look. Sweating cold, crazed, thinking of death, feeling it move deeper, gurgling, in and in. I poured water in to drown it and pried it out with a cuticle knife. Pure dread. I was awake for hours. Late the next day, I was telling how fine the previous day had been, how wrong to end like that. And then slowly, and then suddenly, I realized what the thing in my ear had said. It said, "Listen, this will make you hear what kind of day it was. Slow and warm and fine, a 2-mile run in the rain. A new book on the great Jefferson begun. People pleased with your own book, proofs. Children laughing, calling. And most good, and at the start of your 5th decade, most strange. A beautiful woman loves you so. The dank corners lighten. Listen how she came to you at noon with love. How you went to her at night for love and found the light was in you, singing." I couldn't hear it until now. The brown, ugly, implacable bug saying, "Pay attention. This is back of any perfect day. Madness. The child's death, and will not stop." And saying by the difference, "Will you hear now which side of days you have? Then thank a mystery that speaks your name. Thank every trick in your ear, and listen." And one from this book, it's the shortest, it's called And Morning In. On a fence post, the rooster simply saying to the sun, our father, "Hello, old cock, I'm up again, and so are you." I'll just bother you with this once more, but could you hear that all right in the back? All the way back? Okay. I want to read some poems from this book, Stubborn, now. And I want to intersperse along the way some things I'm working on now. So, here is a poem called Measure for Elizabeth. My daughter Elizabeth, who's 34 now, was 19 and going through some confusing transitions. And I was in upstate New York, and all of the leaves should have fallen, but outside my window was a little maple that seemed to have all of its leaves, but they were a fine faded yellow, and behind them were dark evergreens. And I don't know exactly the connection, even now having written this, but I offer it, Measure for Elizabeth. I don't gauge the light perfection until I see the small maple, slender, full-leafed in its yellows, up against the taller evergreens. The slanting Indian summer seems lofted by late afternoon just over their tops to light this tree, its buff transparencies fragile to airiness, as if so near the edge of every leaf's releasing, a chill would let them down at once. It is deciduous from the Latin verb to fall, and here before it joins an ancient language. It is oriental grace and feminine with delicate sachet, leaning or moving to the permanent green's measure. Yes, slender and just emerging in her name, one arm before her, one hand up to hold the pine needle branch away as she takes quick small steps to enter. I have a poem about writing in a way called Late September, Early Morning, and it's about, it really came about because Garrison Keillor's book, Lake Wobegon Dazed, was on the bestseller list for a year, hardcover for a year. He's an old friend of mine, and this poem came from it, Late September, Early Morning. It's fall, but he's written his fall poems, his harvest poems, and here comes age poems. Few have noticed, but he's tried everything, including birth, life, and death poems, the dying Christ, God, the ministry of work poems, the insouciance, especially Ivan Spornitz's, Bunk McVeigh's, his father, Grandmother Rose, and others. Himself, he's covered like a wall, poster full. He's even tried Alaska and Korea, Bulgaria and Iwo Jima, no visit required. So now, he's trying to wait, patient to strike, under his peculiar illusion and weed, it counts. But something stubborn wants him scribbling daily, even if it is the only thing to write about. Like straw blown through a tree, it's in him, or gratitude, to get up before dawn, to sit at the cricketing window a while, letting it in, and then to put it down here. And after seeing his old friend madly flogging his book, months now atop the Times bestseller list, he's trying to work up a solace that his obscurity, like this early morning's dark, is the perfect light to work in. It didn't work, of course. Here's a poem called What I Have Tried to Say to You. After a tragedy in the family, what I have tried to say to you, that there are ways to love the life you haven't had, ways to forgive the one you have, that while your brother wasn't killed to test anyone, his death is somehow allowed by the mystery requiring our lives to have this permanent pull at the middle. Our lives are what they have been, unrevisable, changed only in our responses, if we are still ready, somehow, for the next day, the next person, poem, chance, even prepared, however unready, for the next death. Can we permanently grieve the boy with hating what has become of him? What has become of him? He has returned to mystery, the same one that is our life, mine and yours, this morning. The continuing shapes we never see up there, this afternoon, tomorrow. So he is already ahead of time in everything we do. I feel it often that I am living my life in part for him, not permanently dead in us, but telling how we'd rather he had lived than not. Remember our game of listening in the park to hear the woods fill up with sounds, birds mostly from farther and farther away the longer we listened. He seems now especially to have listened, raptly, eyes closed, as if to singing, as if he were entering the song. And like the way he usually walked far ahead of us or far behind, already gone to his own music. When I think how long it is since he has entered all silent, it takes me by the heart to think those sounds like light have stayed in whatever we are left to be. That songs we heard those days are from the place he's gone away to, a singing in the mysteries connecting us, if we can stop and be quiet and listen. And after Jim Wright's death, that book came out, The Last Journey, and I wrote this poem called Jim, and it is based on something that happened years ago, right, and I think it was John Logan or James Dickey read at the Newman Center at the University of Minnesota on campus, and Wright had been out to Robert Bly's farm, and he stopped reading and was looking for a poem, and he looked for a briefcase and said, "I guess David ate it." David was Bly's horse, and he had seen the horse over at the edge of the corral with his snout, with his muzzle in the briefcase, and he said, I guess David ate the poem. And if you see Wright's collected poems, you know, there's a blank page that has it top in memory of the horse David, who ate one of my poems, a blank page below it. So, but at any rate, in this reading, after he said, "I think the horse ate my poem," people laughed, and he paused with perfect comic timing and said, "That's all right, I've had my poems chewed up by critics I admire less." So, Jim, I gave my lunch apple to a horse yesterday and remembered the horse who was your friend, David, eating the only copy of one poem in Minnesota. So last night I reread your final book again among the Ohio, French, and especially Italian people and animals of your last journey. Some of the resolved gentleness here makes me cry. Your welcoming of the blue spider, not so much as this late acceptance of the self. I was often moved when you wrote of your preferring lions in his name. Small wonder Jesus wept at a human city. But I am more moved now when you make me believe the turtle to be a man of God, with its religious face, meaning unswervably perfect to itself, I guess. To you, perfect to me in your language. Holding the book I read, watching your father and the fat Ohioans tremble in my hands, I close it at last, and looking at the jacket back, I bid the picture and your name good night. Then in the dark, I try to sleep right through the stone beasts, ghosts, and angels of my stubborn grief who bear Ohio after Fano. I should have reminded you, of course, that Wright is from Ohio, and Fano was this town in Italy that he partly dedicated his last book to Fano, where Annie and I got well, something like that. Well, I think I want to jump a little out of order and read a poem from the new book called Monkey House. I seem to need to do this when I feel I'm being too grave or too taken with myself and my sorrows. So I'm looking for a poem called Monkey House. This is about an occasion that happened when my children were 5 and 3 in the National Zoo in Washington. There'd been a lot of rain for several days, and in all of the big creature enclosures, there were what at the zoo they call carousels. What would we call them in North Dakota? Sort of movable feeding stations. The hay was up above and the creatures would come up and eat. And I didn't write about this for about 25 years. I told about it, and I always was amused by it. It's called Monkey House. For a while, the 3-year-old twins seem as interested as their father, but the 5-year-old keeps tugging his hand. They've been looking at the black rhinos, and the father, leaning and squat, is absorbed in watching a lithe male trying to mount a big, thick cow who faces a carousel of hay, contentedly chewing. Heavy rains have left the ground a muddy gumbo where the rhinos have made paths, as especially all around the carousel. Twice in a row, the dignified cow oblivious, the bull has cranked his hooves and the horny anvil of his head up onto her back. the exposed pink and surprisingly pointed tip of his eagerness has been an inch from entering when his hind hooves begin to sink in the mud and he slides back down. After the second time, all three children are whining, "Let's go, Daddy, let's go." Although the morning is cool, the man's face is hotly flushed. "Just a minute," he explains. "Wait." A third time, the bull rises up until, millimeters from pay dirt, his back legs trembling, the pointy hind hooves slowly sink, and down he falls again. This time he pivots sharply and trots away, then stops, tenses, and voids with great force two rectangular turds in a row, like little hay bales, slap against the mud, whap, whap. In this, the children are interested. They shout, "Wow," and "whap, whap," and point and make delighted rillings of laughter. The father, looking down as if wakened, also begins to laugh, and they stroll away towards the monkey house. This is called Snug Harbor, New Orleans. I gave a reading at LSU and planned to spend the weekend in New Orleans. And when I got to my hotel in the quarter, the room wasn't ready, so I got upgraded to a suite. And so I felt quite expansive the whole weekend. I called my wife and tried to get her to come down. She couldn't. So I just did New Orleans things. And one of them was a saxophone shootout. And it wasn't in the quarter, which is pretty commercial, but way off to the side. And it was recommended to me by Codrescu, who was at LSU, Andre Codrescu. So I went there and had a lot of fun, as I hope the poem suggests. I also went to Brennan's, the famous breakfast place, and asked if I could get breakfast reservations for Sunday. And the lady said, "We have left now only at 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. I said, "Well, I prefer to come in the morning, but can I get a drink at 8 a.m.? You imagine saying this to some worldly wise person in New Orleans. She said, "Darling, this is New Orleans. You can get anything, anytime." Snug Harbor, New Orleans. The soprano saxophone at Snug Harbor, outside the quarter in New Orleans, was stone improvisation for three sets by Black Earl, the boss, Young Black Victor, and Tony, white and young. They were backed up all night by two white players, the drummer, Vidakovich, and one singleton on bass. I liked the plain cat friendliness that came slowly, quiet with the play, for excellence. I liked being in a real jazz joint in New Orleans, grateful to the Bucharest Cajun who sent me there, far from the Bourbon Street dive charging $6 a pop, where only money and booze have jazzed for years. I liked how the white guy, Tony, held his own, less hot, though, and more bookish, whiter, in the free-fall wail. How at ease, cross-color, all five were, musicians, more and more, as the night. I was moved by the riffs, the sonorous blare, the brand-new Bach and Thelonious harmonies, the way they played more things together as if they were finding slowly it. I improvised too, switching drinks, vodka, Jack Daniels, a burger, some rum monsoons, till 3 a.m., then back to the hotel to sleep 4 hours and wake clear as a stone, booze rinsed in a song. 2 weeks later at 4:30, I'm up to say I can still hear those saxes getting down and wish I were Al Young or Matthews or Zimmer, to sing it mournful and joyous, joyful and mourning and gone. I wrote a poem about whiskey. I don't want to read it tonight, it's a little long, but I was very fond of it. And it came from reading an account in a Amherst, Virginia newspaper, the headline of which was "Fading Taste for Bourbon Pinches Kentucky." And it was about all the light beer and the locale wine, all that. So I wrote that, and I was at an artist colony in Virginia, and I heard people in the next studio talking. So I knew they weren't working, and I went and asked them if I could read it to them, and they obliged. And one was a sculptor, painter, and jewelry maker named Nancy, and the other was Mark Richard. And so they indulged me, and I got another poem from that called Gift. Now here is a poem for Nancy, who along with Mark, let me read her my brand new bourbon whiskey poem. Not only because she let me and agreed to my rules beforehand that they must like it, say so, and mean it, and not only because when I'd read it, she liked it and meant it, but also and overridingly may the mystery bless her because she said, wait, first I'm going to lie down. We were in Mark's studio and she lay down on the couch closing her eyes, the better to welcome my whiskey poem. With owing it all my obscure scribbler's life, I have wanted to write one poem a woman beautiful as Nancy would want like that to lie down. I thank her for revealing this, for liking my poem about whiskey and for meaning it, but most for lying down. When I go to the writer's last place, I will say for credentials, I am Flint. I wrote one poem, Nancy the Muse, lay down. Here's a new poem, one I'm working on. The book that's coming out in spring was taken late in 1996. So everything since then is new. And since the book, and since no one's read the book is new as well. But this is something, I mean, I'm working on now. This is called Tributaries, and it's kind of an homage to Garcia Marquez. 10 straight days of rain roiled from clouds with temperatures in the 50s, so you close windows and retrieve the winter PJs, can almost blot how plump and April green is the world of your county now, Montgomery in Maryland, everything ready to bloom. But here is rain and rain and rain to lose you in one long sentence by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. With no way out till the sky has said all it has of cats and dogs, pitchforks and hammerheads, frogs and fish, moths and monkeys, quims and bums, corn silk and willow leaf, jets and pets and lily pads, Dodges, Chevys, steering wheels and rumble seats, the tin, the sluice and runnel of all you love, wetly rinsing your ears until the old woman dies, buried in the sump of her grave. The colonel ascends only to lose in the rank sweat of an illusion. Some heirs meet and marry in the rain. The state falls. The dictator fingers girls. Dreams of sun or snow all turn to rain pouring into the next county or country the next day, week, month, year, drowning the sewers but not the rats. Until all verbs, rivers, and prayers at flood stage, it empties into the sea, on which, just now, the sun begins to shine. You know those moments in Marquez when he describes the rain or anything else for 25 pages, maybe in only two or three sentences, and you think he can't go on, and then he does it for 30 or 40 more pages. That's, I guess, what that comes from. Well, I want to read some pigeon poems, which Allison spoke up so generously. I was at the wedding of a former student 20 years ago, and he had a terrific party at Tavern on the Green, and there was far too much to drink. And my wife and I went back to our hotel and cleverly decided we should have a stinger before going to bed. So the next day we were both a little shaky, and I went out to find some comfort. And I encountered these grouchy New York street pigeons. They don't get out of your way. And I went back to the hotel and wrote this, and then I wrote a lot of these poems. All of the titles go into the poem. So I'll read this one that launched them. They all began in this breezy, sort of crazy way, and then they became other kinds of things. He didn't know he was a pigeon until the day in New York City when he left the rented nest and her he's often called a nest, and was walking bad hungover from the pre-wedding bash to his favorite Wolf's 52nd and 7th for bagel, egg, and aspirin, and his path was blocked by pigeons, and then just fat, rumpled, grouchy, clumsy, and he and the pigeon did a little dance before finding the paths around, and he thought, oh God, I danced like that last night at the fancy dinner, dressed just like a pigeon in the rented tux, colliding with the bride's mother, saying some dumb pigeon Yiddish, and pigeon dancing, drunken, bumbling, stumbling by, pigeon, plain as pigeon. Well, as I say, they changed and became otherwise, but some of them retained a kind of jauntiness. I sent poems to a little magazine that asked me for poems, and this poem came from it. An editor from Buzzard Press writes to the Pigeon saying, thanks for sending the poems as requested. We're shooting 7 back, but one we really like and enclose a copy with a number of changes we think would make the poem stronger. It's a little 28-line versicle. Pigeon worked his tail off on as usual, and they suggest 21 changes. 21! Including striking out half a line, then a whole line, most of the definite articles, like any hapless rookie, and then, the worst to pee, they rewrite a line, providing a bird brain metaphor of their own, changing the line utterly, removing a meaning pigeon planted with ordinary, obsessed, and offhand care. Fuck you very much in his reply, says Raging Pee, but grinning with integrity. Well, as I say, they changed, and here's another kind. Pigeon sees how this scratching of his will be more and more the center. The family and friends he loves are dying of hearts or falling, pills or cancer. And as long as Pigeon is staying on behind, and long he means and wants to do, he must always court and chant the dumbest failures of saying almost exactly what he means. He's not praying for miracles or lost in some delusion he'll get out alive or even for long survive this ugly place he loves in rapt confusion. Pigeon in the night feels a little black hole in his chest and knows it to be his heart, dense with the gravid night, a black invisible diamond weighing in with the cruel impacted buildup, the loss especially this morning, drawing all the others into it, of his own right hand, his heart itself for a while, his son gone forever. He can't quite hang on to Pigeon. The night bores him like this. And finally, the last poem, when her digital clock, I mean the last in this book, I'm not stopping now. I saw people glancing with relief at their watches. Could we be getting out of here this early? Josephine Jacobson, the wonderful poet, told me she was one of the things she was proudest of in her career, that she had never read longer than she was asked to. Usually it's different. And I wrote this little thing about it that's all title except the first line. After reading for 35 minutes, when you ask him to read for 15, because he's sharing the time with 3 other poets, he says, now for some longer pieces. When her digital clock says 5:55, Pigeon knows it's time, and so on Thanksgiving was up, appropriately thankful to be scratching in his pigeon book on this one, old ones, older and older ones, something in them still calls him out of the bed and brings him along. One thing not to give thanks for is 16 years ago today, the young president's death in Dallas, and all the train of griefs it pulled, Martin, Bobby, Malcolm and Medgar, Vietnam and LBJ, who actually said of the war protesters, forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do. And also Watergate, and that other one P won't let into his song at all, except for rhyme, right here, mill house, the charmless, witless, sexless louse. Well, despite Carp's backward and abysms, Pigeon is giving thanks today for the living children, surviving love, for pages up there on which to write, for the fat bird in the oven, for a slender one in his bed, for all his days and nights with her ahead, for whatever else it is at 5:55 that gets him up to scratch the thanking day alive. This is slightly related and it's new. It's called Hydrofoil. My wife and I were staying in an apartment in Milan, and it was a very nice apartment for a on-the-spot rental, but it had kind of thin walls between us and the neighbors. Hydrofoil. Marchini is the name on their door, our neighbors for a month in Milan, who, like us, are early to bed, early to rise, and as we hear them talking, coughing, snoring, leaving early for work each day, we must assume they hear us when we make noise, especially in the bedroom, which seems to abut theirs. We think they fall silent, maybe listening, and so we grow careful, circumspect in our sounds there, with the big rattling headboard, like a curlicued bowsprit against the plaster-thin wall, a sounding board of who we are as a couple, age 63 and 58, how often in the month we sail, and how intense or how ingenious a slant or sideways, trimming our craft to run as deep but silent with instead of against the bangy waves. God, I'm so pleased with myself. I was actually asked to say a little about my work translating from Bulgarian, and I'll say just a little about that and read just a poem. About 20 years ago, someone there began translating my poem. It's a long, interesting story, and I'll try to make it short and not too boring. Someone there began translating my poems, and that led to invitations from the Old Writers Union, which, of course, was an instrument of the Communist Party. But I had a number of problems with that and with them, but I did make friends there, and I began slowly studying the language. William Meredith was preparing an anthology, before he had a stroke, of Bulgarian poems in translation, and almost all of these, maybe all of them, were by the agency of Bulgarian scholars who had made word-by-word translation of Bulgarian poems into English. And then Meredith farmed them out to different American poets to do versions of. And lots of, as many of you know, lots of translation in America gets done away. I continued to study Bulgarian and to try to read in Bulgarian. And I translated an article by a fascinating writer named Jordan Radichkov. It was in a literary newspaper. And I got hooked because there was only about an inch and a half of text on the front page, and I didn't need a dictionary for any of it. It gave me delusions of translation. And I translated the whole thing, and it was long, and it was about his lamenting the decision of the city of Sofia to widen one of the principal boulevards because that involved cutting down some very old chestnut trees along the side of it. And he's a very cranky and peculiar writer. I learned a lot of Bulgarian doing that. But I still, all of my translation since then has been done with a Bulgarian poet who now happens to live near me in Maryland, good English. His wife, excellent English, and we translate together. I read everything in Bulgarian. I look up everything I don't understand, but I have him as a check against making terrible mistakes, which it is easy to do. When I was studying, I got by heart almost all of the poems offered, mostly children's poems. And it's amazing how often constructions from them were useful in conversation when I got brave enough to try to converse. And I was with two, this is interesting to me and is relevant, I was with two women one day in Sofia, and we bought strawberries from a greengrocer, and they were the best strawberries I'd ever had, and they thought they were wonderful too, and they called them strawberries like raspberries, Jagody Katomalini. They were tiny, and they were delicious, and they said, Garian, they say Jagody Katomalini. They're strawberries like raspberries. And I thought that was a varietal of this strawberry. I mean, I thought that was a varietal of a strawberry. And the next day I went to the greengrocer and in my best Bulgarian said, are there any raspberryan strawberries? He thought I was very peculiar. But he was amused. Boris Ristov, a wonderful poet, wanted a new translation of his poem. They're already translated in English. He wanted new translation. And he called my friend Lubo, and we sat down and for about 2 months did almost nothing else but work on these translations. And he went on to write other shorter ones, a whole book of three-line poems. I'm going to read you a few of those, and a couple by this man, Lyubomir Nikolov, who has a book from Carnegie Mellon Press called Pagan. I think it's 1992, and his wife and I are listed as the translators. But we all three, in fact, worked on them. First, Nikolov's, just two poems. The first is called Axes. The axes lie next to the river, and their smooth handles glisten. On many stumps the ants swarm. Like brides in black, they bustle. Birds fly over the branches. In the branches themselves, sap wells. The axes lie waiting and near. The axes lie next to the river. Oh, how we honed them once. Against our thumbs we tested them all summer and looked at ourselves in their blades. The axes lie next to the river. It smells here of lichen, frogs croak. Deep in the valley, fog clears. With fruit brandy, we rinse our throats. The axes to the river. The axe heads lie cold as steel, cold as death with a polished handle. They wait for us to seize them, and they rust in the spiky grass. If you knew more of his poems, you might know the point that he is trying to make, and that is some of the things that stopped working well under the regime. And the last one is called In a Poet's Museum. Where are the blueprints for the stars? Where is the logbook of the sea and the genealogy of the briar in blossom? The poem is a fox. With its tail, it wipes away its tracks. That's Lyubomir Nikolov. I'll just read some of these peculiar three-line poems by Boris Ristov. He has as an epigraph to this book a dedication for Emil, in whose memory I vowed to compress my words into three lines, to write a book of titles alone, to then free myself even of these, and enter the poetry of silence in which he lives. And many of these say that he's going to give it up. Beginning, and the dead will come here again, like fish to the places where they let their eggs go. Voice of an Egyptian priest from an old inkwell in front of me. Fool, everything has been said, and long ago. It's the beginning of his. Here's one called Egg. Tap on him, but gently. Man is still only an egg. This is called Vocation. His vocation found at last, the executioner rejoices. Here is a place I will be useful. Forgive me for skipping about. I just want to read a few. He talked a long time, but when he saw his words would not defeat me, he took off his clothes and went naked. Work. Work. No one has died for years, but I hear the coffin maker working, convinced his labor is useful. Butterfly. Here's one of my favorites. Butterfly in Bulgarian is peperuda. Butterfly. Her wings drooping over a plucked flower. She is a widow, come to the grave in a bridal gown. Discovery. How good it is to let a thought go, not to write it down, to let it fly to freedom. A writer growing weary. Here, confession. It is plasma, not a bone. Poetry may connect, but it cannot carry. Lament. What a sad fate. Another fornicates with the model, and you sing her praises. Oh, maybe just one. Salt water on sweet water. What's the sense for centuries on your shore to write words upon other words? I'm turning now to the book, and now for some longer pieces. This is called Little Men Who Come Blindly. That's from Stephen Crane. The third and fourth generations of them that hate me. And he writes bravely, well, then I hate thee. Wicked image, I hate thee. Strike with thy vengeance the heads of those little men who come blindly. It will be a brave thing. Little men who come blindly. Here is my neighbor, a young man, in the street with his son, who is about six, and has his first bicycle. Like this, Dad, he says, and his father says, no, get on like this. Like this, Dad, asks the boy, and his father says, no, like this. When we take the training wheels off, you'll fall if you get on like that. The boy is on the bike now and says, like this, Dad? No, says his father. Sit back more. Relax. Like this? No. No. And so it goes till they are out of my hearing at last. I resume cutting the grass with something else making an echo. How the boy's heart ratchets in his voice. And I pray I never broke from my children's voices a hurt unfixable as that. And while its hasping echoes, I think of a fine novelist in whose teaching the precise negatives, word by mincing word, paralyze student writers. Not seeing any connection, he tells us how his parents, and especially father, never approved of anything he did as long as they lived. He knows that it literally and then otherwise crippled him, that it took years of war and stories, his talent, to save him. And there was my old student who works with the urban poor, bringing us his adopted son, a black-haired boy named Thomas, whom he rebuked harshly in front of us, and who said, when our friend stepped out, my dad don't like me. What can we tell the fathers? And what shall I do with how this sounds in me if writing it down isn't enough? What can I say to the writer so he forgives his father's hurt enough to trust his students' failures, to see them and see himself? What can I say to my neighbor, young enough to be my son, some healing words to change him without offense, to help him and help him? Nothing. So I tell you, is it any use to you? I have a poem called Austere that takes as an epigraph the last two lines of a wonderful poem by Robert Hayden. And as a break from myself, I think I'll say that. It's called Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made bank fire flames. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call. And slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. I know. What did I know of love's austere and lonely office? Hayden was the first African-American consultant in poetry, as many of you know, at the Library of Congress, before it was called National Poet Laureate. So the last two lines are under a title, Austere, for my mother, who had six children in a farmhouse in North Dakota, where there was no central heat or electricity or running water. Austere, how she left kettles of water on the kitchen stove for baths each Saturday night till hotter than needed at cold, to wash in the corrugated tub the week's field dirt away, blown even into the crib from a North Dakota sky. As all of us take turns, the young mother renewing clean heat for each till it runs out as she's finishing hers. I offer you her kettles, stove, the kerosene lamp, light, her palm, her soap, her olive, the tub, its velvety silk. Here's a poem about my grandmother and sort of about baseball. It's called Near Our Villa, North Dakota, 1941. You go with Grandma to McSherry's farm, where in her mid-60s she works as cook, housekeeper, servant, and your local parent. Avid for the farm, you were generally obedient, but especially drawn to the bullpen because she'd scared you about its danger, or for a mystery between the bull and you, his nostrils snorting you on. The horns where they rasped the name, his male fat sack, a sway with jewels you could fix, could you just whack it with a bat? Grandma terrified at the window, too late you dreamed to stop you. And while he groomed his horn, chewed or splashily peed, the dream went on, he seeing but ignoring you, a great pitcher with a pesky runner on first, a few feet off the bag, testing the bottom strand. Okay, I actually am going to finish pretty soon. Early tomorrow. Here is one called Henry and June, the movie. You know, Henry Miller and Anais Nin. All that gang. There was a movie about it. Stanley Kaufman doesn't like it. And okay, it drags a little. But there are some moments, as when Anais tells Henry she's happy they fit so good. How sometimes she has to Vaseline her husband's Hugo. And Henry snaps a quarter-second stare that says he too's been taught the faith of every modest male that all dicks are roughly the same. Stan is on the money about June or the tall invert who plays her. What a honey furnace she is, especially with her dampers down. But if he really means it when he says the Anais isn't sexy, Stanley needs an oil change or a lube job. And he'd better get that tailpipe checked. Well, I'm looking for poems that are short and engage in certain ways. Here's a theft from Robert Frost and from a student of mine. It's called Never Again with Birdsong. A pretty girl writes in her journal, she probably shouldn't put this here, but she's had the best sex ever in her life. Fresh is 22. Says she's had her first orgasm during intercourse. That they both came at the same time. That she finally sees what all the fuss is about. How this guy is also fun. The laughing they do before and after. How it may not, probably won't last, but what the hell? It's so good now. And you resist jotting her your theory that laughter and orgasm are connected. Those who have a lot of one are likelier than most to have a lot of the other. But she must know this in her skin. We love to make who make us laugh, even before we feel them one. Come funny, honey bone, funny come. All right. Two more. Well, I'll make it three. I'll tell you my daughter Elizabeth's first poem. We changed schools and put them into a Catholic school when she was eight, and they really hadn't had, she and her sister, any religious training. And the nuns asked for a Christmas poem. And Elizabeth wrote this and asked me if I thought it was right. I said I liked it very much. I didn't know what the nun would think, but I honestly liked it very much. I call it The Hard-Nosed Noel. Jesus was born on Christmas Day, under the straw, under the hay. He's dead now, as everyone knows. Nails in his fingers, nails in his toes. Bither was offered a scholarship for an MFA at Tucson. I don't think she submitted that. She did get one at the University of Virginia, and her sister and I went down to Charlottesville to hear her reading, which they do as they're finishing. And she began with that poem. I was very proud of her. Here's a poem for my other daughter called Pamela. She did something extraordinary, and reminding me of times I wished I had done something. A former student called me, and his wife had a baby who lived only 2 days. And he knew I'd lost a child. And I asked him if he wanted me to come, and he said no. But I shouldn't have asked. You know, I should have taken the call as enough of a call to go. And then if I was of no use to him, I wouldn't have been hurt. I could have just come home. It was Washington to New York. Well, my daughter went from Washington to California. When she was called. She was going to Georgetown. She was working in a car dealership in Arlington. And she just went to California on her very fragile credit card. It's called Pamela. Praise for Pamela Helen Flint, who, when Rick's mother called to say her son was dying, left at once, expensive, to fly from Virginia to California to see, and as it turned out, to be the only one with him when he died. Of age, at 27. Went because she's loved him since they were 14, maybe before either knew the complicated calls of sex, specific measures of need or predilection, but went on as each had promised each in love for life. And so just left school and job and kin, catching the first flight out, rented a car in Fresno, drove 50 miles to the hospital to be with him. So he knew it, a wordless surge of greeting at her voice and touch. May all who need one at the end have such a friend. Praise. And at last, this is the last poem in the new book. It's called Prayer. And in it I say, Dio volente, which is not a mistake for the Latin, but Italian, meaning the same thing, God grant, or God willing. Any day's writing may be the last. He's reminded at 2 in the morning. I'm going to stop to say this owes a little, to that Merwin poem in which he remarks the obvious but spooky idea that each year we live through the calendar date on which eventually we'll die. I think it owes a little to that prayer. Any day's writing may be the last, he's reminded at 2 in the morning, making this year's last Italian notes, readying his machine and self to get aboard the bigger machine and fly Dio Volente home. And so he repeats the Our Father, he said to himself before rising, and feels a heartfelt thanks, Lord, for such poems as have come his way, whether or not they get read, and it goes without saying, few may. And thanks as well for eagerness almost daily to greet the drone with words bequeathed in part by what poets before have done. He prays to be among them, one, however small, the work is all. I don't take it as a request for an encore, but it made me remember a New Yorker cartoon that it might be like. The usual thing is the fighter is all battered in his corner and his manager says, go out and kill him again. But the New Yorker had one in which this guy is very badly beaten and his manager looks terrified and says, look out, here he comes again. Didn't want you to think that I was coming back to